Okay, I'm ready to go. Hope everyone else is ready as well. Welcome to the fifth session. We're a week behind because I was unable to give a class a few weeks ago. And we're now launching our way into the religious world and the religious variety of Babylonia and Sasanian Iran during the Talmudic era. And the way we wanted to do this, to just get a sense of the variety of religion, we didn't really get to look at this source in detail last week, is to look at an inscription that was inscribed in actually four sites throughout Iran in the third century of the Common Era. And it's an inscription of a fellow named Kirdir, who was a high Zoroastrian priest. I'll explain who the Zoroastrians were in a minute. But all you need to know now was that Zoroastrianism, as we've discussed, was the, so to speak, state religion of the Iranian Sasanian Empire. And Kirdir was instrumental in kind of solidifying the support of Zoroastrianism. He charts in this inscription a career. He starts off as a relatively low Zoroastrian priest and makes his way up the ranks until ultimately he's in very deep and very close with the Sasanian rulers. And the man also lived for a very long time, especially given the how long people used to live then. So this is Kirdir, and this is from his inscription. I want to look at the first source on the handout that you can see right now. So if you remember last week, we looked at some Sasanian inscriptions of the king that charted the geography of the empire. And we noted that even though Babylonia is not historically an Iranian land, in other words, indigenous people in Babylonia never spoke any Iranian language. They spoke Semitic languages like Aramaic, Akkadian, etc. Nevertheless, in that inscription, in a few inscriptions that chart the geography of the Sasanian Empire, Babylonia is considered to be the heart of the Iranian Empire, at least for political reasons and in a political sense. The inscription, the part of the inscription that we're going to look at now, in Kirdir's inscription, actually charts kind of, you can say, the religious terrain of the empire. It gives you a sense as to who was there, what were the main communities, and how did they fare under the Zoroastrians, or at least the way Kirdir describes in the third century. So let's read that source. He says, and he's bragging. The whole point of an inscription is just to brag, right? You want to tell people and for posterity, future generations, all the great things that you did. And this is what he does in this inscription. So for example, he says, from province to province, place to place throughout the empire, and I should note that that form, some of you might recognize from Megillat Esther. There are a few psukim that use that basic form, and this kind of demonstrates and reflects the conservatism of these inscriptions, Persian inscriptions in general, where they'll use linguistic forms all the way from Achaemenid times, such as we find in Gilad Esther. So here he's saying, and from province to province, place to place, throughout the empire, the rites of Ormazd and the gods became more important. So now we know a little about Kirdir's religion, that it's good for him if a figure, a god named Ormazd, ascends and becomes more important, and the gods as well are important in that process. And then he says, and the Mazda Yasnian religion and Magians were greatly honored in the empire. Another bit of a brag. He says that the Mazda Yasnian religion and the priests of that religion, the Magians, were greatly honored in the empire. I just want to dwell for a moment on that word. Generally, when we're going to be discussing Zoroastrianism, we'll refer to the people who practice this religion as Zoroastrians. And that name is taken from the main figure, both in the ancient, their ancient texts and their late antique and medieval texts, named Zoroaster. That's the Greek form of his name. But these people usually refer to themselves as Mazda Yasmian. Yasmian means those who worship. So that part doesn't really give us a sense of who they worship. But Mazda is what they worship. And no, they, again, I think I used this corny joke before, they did not or do not worship the car, the Mazda, but they do worship a god named, at least in the old form, of Ura Mazda, Lord Mazda, Lord Wisdom. And also, you can see that reflected in the name we just saw a line ago, Ormaz. Ormaz is just a later form of that name, Ahura Mazda. So these people refer to themselves as Mazda Yasmian, worshipping Mazda, the Lord Wisdom, which was their primary god. And that Kurder took great credit for making sure that they did well and were greatly honored in the empire. He then continues with his brag, and he says, great satisfaction befell the gods, and water, and fire, and cattle. So he also tells us that there are other important religious sacred elements in this religion. It's not just the primary good spirit, Ahura Mazda, the good god Ahura Mazda. Things that are also worthy of worship are gods, these sort of good figures that are associated with Ahura Mazda, water, fire, and cattle. Now fire, we'll begin with fire. It's well known that Zoroastrians, so to speak, worshipped fire and were known as fire worshippers by people in the West because many of their rituals took place in what's called a fire temple, and that's how they, primarily how they served the deity or the deities. So that's clear. And they also demanded a high level of purity when it came to fire. I wish we had time to do this today, but there are a few Gemaras that that give a sense of the difficulty of celebrating Hanukkah at certain points in the in Talmudic times in Babylonia, because Zoroastrians thought that Jews would not treat fire with the proper respect, or the proper sense of purity. And there are a few lines about this in the Gemara. One Gemara tells us that one's even allowed to move a Chanukiah on Shabbat if there is concern that it'll be seized by the authorities. So fire was very important for Zoroastrian religion. Water was as well. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that as well, but it was very important not to convey impurity to water. And also cattle, primarily the cow, which is something we also find in Indian religions, was also considered to be sacred and had to be treated with the proper respect. So he describes, again, he's boasting, not only has he done good to his god Ormaz and these other gods that are associated with Ormaz, not only has he done good with the religion in general and the priests of the religion, but he also has made sure that these sacred elements, water, fire, and cattle, have great satisfaction. And here he gives us the other side of the coin. And actually, this is a very important structural feature of this inscription, of many of the inscriptions, that they're built according to a dualistic format. Good things happen to things and people who are deemed good, and bad things occur to people and objects and elements that are deemed bad. So he said, and great blows and torments befell Ahriman and the demons. In other words, on the one side, on the good side, Kurder has Ormaz and these other good gods. And on the other side, he has Ahriman, which is the evil god, the evil spirit, and the demon. Okay? And he continues, not only did the figures themselves suffer, but also the faith of Ahriman, the demons, disappeared from the empire and lost credibility. It's unclear which religion he's referring to, but there's some religion that good Zoroastrians thought of as the faith of the evil god, Ahriman of the demons. And then he gives us a list. of different religions. And again, that's what I was referring to when I said how he maps the geographic terrain. And he says as follows, and Jews and Buddhists and Hindus and Nazarenes and Christians and Baptists and Manichaeans were smitten in the empire, and the idols were destroyed, and the abodes of the demons disrupted and made into thrones and seats of the gods. So he gives us a list of all the major different religions that were active in the Sasanian Empire. And if you just look at the list, it's pretty incredible to see the kind of variety you have. You have Jews. You have two Far Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, and those practitioners were there as well. Unclear if there were many of them in Babylonia, but certainly they were there in the Iranian Empire. Then you have two groups called Nazarenes and Christians. These seem to be two different Christian communities. The Christians, the word in the inscription is pretty similar, Christianon, Christiani, are Greek-speaking Christians who were settled in the Sasanian Empire after wars, and the Nazarenes most probably were Eastern Aramaic or Syriac speaking Christians. So really Nazarenes and Christians are two different Christian communities. You have Baptists, and we're not talking about the Southern Baptists, but religions where baptism, immersion in water, was deemed to be very important, perhaps the Mandaeans. And finally we have the Manichaeans, which is another dualistic religion that we're going to discuss next week. The reason why Kurzer lists all of these different religions is because, again, he's boasting. And he's boasting how all of these groups were smitten under his reign. Almost as if he's bragging about persecution, which is definitely interesting. Now, what's also interesting is that there isn't a good deal of evidence that Jews, or even Christians for that matter, at this point in history were terribly persecuted. After Rome turns Christian, then the Christians really take a hit and are persecuted at various times throughout Sasanian history. But regardless, during this period, during the 3rd century, there aren't that many indications that these communities were really persecuted to a great degree. So we do have, as I said, a few scattered lines about candelabras or menorahs specifically being seized by Zoroastrian priests who apparently were concerned about the purity of the fire. We have a few references to a gezeira against eating meat. This is a sugya nivamot, where there's a discussion of a kind of midim kenegan mida, because Jews were not careful with something, so therefore they were punished with a very similar thing. This is the well-known concept of midim kenegan mida. So in that list, there are a couple of interesting things that relate to this inscription. One of them is water, because Jews were not careful with tefillah, so the bathhouses, the marchatzaot, were closed by the Persians, and that seems to be a reference to both, it seems to be the reference to the fact that the Persians were not happy with the way Jews were treating water. It seems that tvila was problematic in their eyes. And also, meat as well was decreed against, according to the Gemara in Yevamot, because they weren't careful with the special gifts that you're supposed to give certain parts of the animal after Shkita to the proper Kohanim. And the Persians persecuted not only Mida Kenek and Mida, but also because they apparently weren't happy with Jewish Shkita. Remember, they were very insistent on the proper care of cattle, and they did not want to draw blood when cattle was slaughtered, etc. So you do have a few of these references to persecution, but persecution did not take place throughout Sasanian times, and didn't seem to be that bad, especially when we compare it with other persecutions in Jewish history. and even to an extent in the Roman Empire. Now, the reason why I chose this inscription is really kind of as a launching pad to talk about all of these different religions that were factors in the lives of Jews living in the Sasanian Empire and therefore in the Talmud. And I think the best religion to start with is Kurdish religion, right? Which is, again, the religion of the Sasanian state. What was, actually, before we just go on to that, are there any questions? Because this is really kind of new material in a way that Mikolos, you know, from the Gemara aren't. Any questions? You can either type it in or raise your hand. Okay. Doesn't look like anyone's asking a question. Let's talk about what Zoroastrianism is before we look at maybe what kind of factor it plays. Now, I mentioned in Kurdish inscription a few things. There are these sacred elements like water, fire, and cattle. There is, on the one hand, a good god and a kind of array of gods named Ormaz or Huramazda. And on the other side, you have an evil god named Ahriman, who is to be defeated. I think the best text to look at to get a sense of what it meant to be a Zoroastrian is from a catechism, a text that a good Zoroastrian child, as they reached the age of 15, was supposed to memorize. Let's look at it quickly. This is the next source that we have scrolled down to in the handout. It's called the Panamech. And look at the introduction. So it says, the teachers of old who have the foremost knowledge about the revelation of the religion have said, each human being, when he reaches the age of 15, should know the following matters. So these things, every human being, or at least Zoroastrian believer, has to know the following answers to the following questions. And look at the questions here. Who am I, and to whom do I belong? Where did I come from, and to where will I go back? And of what lineage and family am I? And what are my duties in the material existence, which is this world? And what is my reward in the spiritual existence, which is their concept of the kind of world of thought, the world that can't be seen? And did I come from heaven, or have I always been on earth? And here's a very important question for our purposes. Do I belong to Ormaz, or do I belong to Ahriman? Do I belong to the gods, or do I belong to the demons? Do I belong to the good, or do I belong to the bad? Am I a human or a demon? How many are the paths, and which is my religion? Etc., etc. I'm not going to read through all of the questions. Let's skip down a bit and look at the answers that these kids need to know. Now, he can explain the meanings, has taken this in hand, and this is his conviction, and as it has been transmitted to him by way of his wisdom. Indeed, one should know without any doubt that, and here are some of the answers, I have come from heaven. I have not always been on earth. I am something created, not something that has always been. I belong to Ormaz and not to Ahriman. I belong to the gods, not to the demons. I belong to the good, not to the bad. I am a human, not a demon. I am a creature of Ormaz, I am not the creature of Ahriman. And my lineage and family is from Geomar, which is their concept of the first man. And etc., etc., other interesting things that are listed there. If we skip down, so before we just finish that text, I think it's very interesting. The purpose of a catechism is to build religious identity and broader identity. The way it's done is by, again, a dualistic structure. There are basically two options. The good option, in their eyes, is the one that should be chosen, and that's the side of Ormaz and all the gods. And the bad option, the demonic option of this other evil force, is on the other side of things. And in addition, there's a strong element of lineage and family. This is a religion that is defined in very ethnic terms. To be an Iranian isn't simply to believe in certain principles. It is actually to trace yourself through a certain lineage. And the text, and this is just an excerpt of the text, if you look a little down here, you'll see some of the important things. Hold on. Some of the important things that they need to do. And on earth, firstly, I have to be a firm believer in the religion, to perform and worship according to it and not to turn away from it, to have faith in one's mind in the good religion of the Matthiasians, to distinguish what is good from what is bad, evil doing from well doing, and goodness from badness, and light from darkness. I thought that I had put a list of the tasks that they need to do. I didn't. But let me just give you a sense. As much as this text that we have read is focused on beliefs and theology, Zoroastrianism is a very practice-centered religion, right? Law and ritual is very important in the religion. So there are certain laws of purity that have to be kept. Yeah, as we said, you have to keep impurity away from fire and water. And they have a whole set of menstrual laws and corpse impurity laws, etc., etc. That's a big part of what it means to be a Zoroastrian. And again, the most central idea, which has ramifications both in theology and in practice, is the idea of dualism, that there is a good God and there is a bad God. The proper tasks, if you will, the mitzvot, their commandments, are those tasks which advance the side of the good God and help defeat the evil God. And therefore, the idea is that the Zoroastrian believer would see themselves as involved in kind of the cosmic task of bringing about the ultimate defeat of evil and the victory of the good. That's sort of the religion in a nutshell. Obviously, you can't really do a religion in a nutshell, but we don't have time. That is sort of a basic sense as to what's going on. Now, if we want to think about the impact and the relationship between Zoroastrianism and Judaism, particularly in the times of the Gemara, of the Bavli, we would be able to speak for hours and hours and days and days. We don't really have time to do that. What I'm interested in is a question that I asked myself a long time ago when I was learning Masechet Avodah Zarah, and I didn't really find the answer there. I think the answer can be found in the Gemara and Shabbat. And the question is, in very sort of crass, basic terms, did Chazal think that Zoroastrianism was Avodah Zarah? Right? Or what kind of religion, what did they consider Zoroastrianism to be? Now, we saw something very interesting. I'm going to scroll up for a second in the Kurdir inscription. Kurdir refers not only to smiting these religions, Jews and Buddhists, etc., but also to the smashing of idols and the abodes of the demons, etc., etc. So you get there a sense of the iconoclasm of the religion. In other words, as much as there is not only this good God, but there's also a bad God, and there are all kinds of good gods that are on the good God side, and bad demons that are on the bad God side, there is very little in terms of physical descriptions of these characters. Like, in other words, in the earliest sources, it's really, they talk about concepts more than kind of fleshed out pictures of gods like you might have in Greek mythology. And for the most part, based on the archaeological record and also their own texts, they did not have idols or many symbols and signs that were worshipped in their temples. But they did perform certain sacrifices, as they call it, with fire and with homa, a substance, but they didn't seem to use idols or images, and in fact, they were against the use of idols, and there you can see Kurdir boasts of smashing idols. So that makes the question very interesting as to what Chazal thought of this religion. In other words, when you do look at Masechet Avodah Zarah, you find most of it follows the way of the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is in a Roman, Greco-Roman context, where the Mishnah is from Eretz Yisrael and deals with some of the problems of living in Eretz Yisrael in terms of Avodah Zarah. So you have discussions of whether Aphrodite is considered to be problematic in a bathhouse. And you have all different kinds of pieces of realia from that world, from the world, the Greco-Roman world. Even the Bavli, for the most part, doesn't really bring the discussion to Avodah Zarah, or let's just say non-Jewish religions in Bava. You do have a couple of lines about different holidays, different Persian holidays, where the halakha and the mission is one is not allowed to do business either on those days in Bavel or 3 days before. We won't go into that now, but for the most part, there really isn't any direct treatment of the main religion in the empire, which is something interesting. Yet, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that does seem to kind of take up that issue, and I want to look at it quickly. This is from Masechta Shabbos, Daf Ayin Hei Amud Aleph. And we find a list of things quoted in the name of Rav. Basically, what unifies all of these things is that you might have thought that they weren't so bad, and Rav tells you, no, they're really bad. Right? So, for example, Hamoteach Chut Shal Tfira B'Shabbat Chayav. This refers to an issue in Hilchos Shabbos. If you kind of pull the string of the bottom of a garment on Shabbos, you are chayav chatas. Don't think that you're not chayav for that. Then he says, and this is what we're going to focus on, the halomei davar min hamagosh chayav mita. Someone who learns davar, something, from a magosh. Remember, we saw that word in Kurdish inscription, a magian. It doesn't simply mean a magician, though there's a relationship between the word magic and a magian. It refers to a Zoroastrian priest. So halomei devar min hamagosh, someone who learns something from a magosh, is chayav mita, is worthy of death. Vahyodea lachashev, v'tzkufot u'mazalot, v'enu mechashev, asur l'saperimet. And someone who has the capability, the training, to be able to figure out calendrical and astronomical calculations, which of course are very important in halacha, and yet doesn't, it's forbidden to talk with them. They should kind of be cast aside. Also, you might have thought that it's not such a big deal, but it is a big deal. Right? So again, our focus is on these words, though, in the middle, halomei devar min hamagosh chayav mita. Someone who learns a devar from a Magian, a Zoroastrian priest, is worthy of death. Now, this is a very strong statement, and it assumes that Jews were learning from Zoroastrian priests, because if not, why would Rav have to say one who learns something from a Zoroastrian priest is chayav mita? If you want to think about it in the context of nowadays, and you were to look for a Pashkevil, a Stein, in Williamsburg, or better yet, in Mea Sharim, that were to say, someone who learns from a Hindu priest, or even a Christian priest, is worthy of death, the sign wouldn't make any sense. Because in Mea Sharim, no one's learning from Christian priests. For some reason, it seems that people in this context were learning things from Zoroastrian priests, and Rav is reminding them that they're being over a serious prohibition in Isser Chamor, and they are Chayv Mita. So there is a bit of a mystery here as to who these people were and why they would want to learn something from a Zoroastrian priest. I'll try to address that answer in a bit, but we don't really have time that much to deal with it. What I'm really interested is in the Gemara that comes right after this, and it's related to this question. And here I think we have a Gemara dealing with the status of Zoroastrianism. Amgushata, right, which seems to be in good Aramaic, Magianism, or Zoroastrianism, right? That form could either mean, could be Lashon Nekeva, could be the female form of the noun, a Zoroastrian priestess, but the word Zoroastrian priestess, it seems that it refers to the concept, the better than concept, the phenomenon of Zoroastrianism. We'll have to see what exactly the Gemara is referring to. But the question is going to be about a certain status of Zoroastrianism. And there's a debate between the two Amoraim, Rav and Shmuel. These are two prominent first-generation Amoraim, right, towards the beginning of the 3rd century. They debate what its status. Chad Amar Charshe, one says that it is sorcery. V'chad Amar Yidufe, and one said that it's blasphemy. So you have a debate between the two Amarayim as to what Zoroastrianism is. Is it sorcery, or is it blasphemy, or blasphemies, really, because it's in the plural form. Now, obviously, the question is not about Zoroastrianism in general as a religion, right? Often people didn't even think about religions in that way, sort of this broad concept of the religion of Christianity or the religion of Zoroastrianism. They're focused on tasks, or even central tasks and acts of that religion. From the fact that one of the options here is blasphemy, that means what's going on here is there must be reference to a speech act. In other words, a central speech act of Zoroastrianism. What is it considered to be in halacha? Is it considered to be like sorcery? Or is it considered to be as blasphemy? Now, blasphemy, the technical definition, the halachic definition of blasphemy, is actually to curse the name of God, God forbid, though there are somewhat wider possibilities, but the strict definition is cursing the name of God. Sorcery is a much broader category, which can refer to any sort of magical practice that is considered to be in the ways of the Amorites, right, which is a category in halacha. So their debate is whether this is considered to be blasphemy, like blaspheming the name of God, or is it considered to be basically full of problematic incantations? That's what the question is. Now there's a big question, there's a debate from the Rishonim on, as to what the context of Rav and Shmuel's debate is. Usually, we have a debate like this about a Braita or a Mishnah. In other words, there'll be a term in a Braita and a Mishnah, and Rav and Shmuel will try to define it. Yet there's no Braita or Mishnah that talks about Amgushata. So I'm going to suggest that this is a debate whose context, at least, takes place in Maseches Sanhedrin. In other words, in Maseches Sanhedrin, there are lists of prohibited acts and prohibited speech acts. Some of them are forms of sorcery, some of them are forms of blasphemy, and there's a whole set of halachos referring to what kind of punishment is received that treats these things. So I want to say that this machloket is basically, its context should be in Maseches Sanhedrin, and the question is, what category does it fall into? Is it kishuv, or is it giduv, right? Is it megade or mechashe? That's the question here. And the debate runs between Rav and Shmuel. Now, the end of the Gemara, tries to use the first part of the Gemara to prove which Amora said what. Right? In the debate about the Zoroastrian speech act, we don't know who said what. So it tries to use that first thing that Rav said to prove that it was Rav who referred to Gidufe. And let's look at that right now. Tistayim de Rav hu damer Gidufe, we can prove that it was Rav who considers the central Zoroastrian speech act to be Giduf. Da amar Rav, Zutra Bartubi amar Rav, halamei devar min hamagosh chayav mita. He has a very strict prohibition for even studying these utterances, these things from Zoroastrian priests, and he says one is liable death, so therefore we can prove that he must think that it is blasphemy. As the Gemara continues, the Isakadaita Charshe, if you were to consider it merely to be forms of sorcery, we have a drash. We have a Midrash Halacha in the Sifri that teaches us that only performing sorcerous acts that are considered to be ways of the Amorites, is considered to be prohibited, but merely to study it is, and to rule according to it is considered to be permitted. Therefore, it must be Rav who said it's not merely sorcery, rather it's blasphemy. And blasphemy, one is not even permitted to study. And the Gemara is happy with this way of understanding the machlok between Rav and Shmuel. In other words, the Gemara understands that Rav and Shmuel's debate is really Rav considered this Zoroastrian speech act to be a form of blasphemy, and Shmuel's to be a form of sorcery. Any quick questions? It's kind of a hard source. I didn't have time to really do it justice. No questions. Okay. Let's talk about what kind of Zoroastrian speech act we're talking about that Rav and Shmuel were debating. Right? What is going on here? And also, again, why might people have wanted to learn from these Zoroastrian priests? I want to look at a very interesting text that comes from another one of the communities that Kurdir referred to, and that was Christians. The Christians left a number of things behind from the Sasanian Empire. And one of the things they left was a genre of martyrology, a text that described the martyrdom of Christians who were persecuted by Zoroastrians and the government, for that matter. Often in these sources, there's a conversion of a Zoroastrian to Christianity, and that's what gets the ire of the Zoroastrian and official sustaining authorities, and that's why they persecute and ultimately kill these newly converted Christians. In one of the texts about a guy named Mar Abba, right, Abba with a common Aramaic name, not necessarily Jewish, we get a sense as to what people thought about what Zoroastrians do. All the Magians from all Persia gather there to learn the murmur. The verb used here is retna. It's a Syriac. This text is in Syriac, which is a very similar language. It's an Aramaic language to the Aramaic that we know from the Gemara and from Targum Onkelos. So it says that all the Zoroastrian priests from all of Persia gather in this Zoroastrian school. Academy, I guess you could call it, to learn the murmur of Zardush, son of Svetama, that's Zoroaster. These people are opposed to truth. They walk about in groups and factions and walk behind their masters. They whisper the foolishness of their blasphemy. They mumble and talk indistinctively. And there are a few similar descriptions by Christians in these texts that describe the main thing that Zoroastrians do is constantly mumbling the teaching of their prophet, of Zoroaster, and it seems to be an oral teaching because they're walking behind their masters, whispering it, etc., etc. They seem to be memorizing the teachings of their prophet. And in fact, if you look at the Zoroastrian texts themselves, which describe what religious study is all about, they talk about oral memorization. These things were not written down for a long time. And the text that we're talking about primarily is what we might call the Zoroastrian Bible, the Avesta. The Avesta is an ancient oral scripture that includes things from as early as 1200 BCE, if maybe even 1500 BCE, based on linguistic analysis, and all the way up until, let's say, 600 BCE. This is their Bible, so to speak, and that Bible came with a commentarial tradition, a translation and discussions, and this was the main focus of Zoroastrian learning, and to a certain extent, Zoroastrian ritual. When a Zoroastrian service was performed, they would recite, and they still do recite, parts of the Avesta. And this is something that both Christians, and I want to argue in our sugya, Jews as well, picked up on. That Zoroastrians were known to, at least in the eyes of foreigners, mumble their religious texts. And I think that might be what's going on in Rav and Shmuel's discussion. But before we get back to that, I want to bring you one more fascinating piece of evidence that this feature of Zoroastrianism, the recitation and the repetition of their Avesta, of their Bible, was something that looms large in the eyes of Jews and Christians. Let's look at Dvarim Perek Yudchet, which is actually where that drasha was taken from, that taught that sorcery is something that is permitted to be studied. It's only its practice which is prohibited. It says in Dvar, Ki atabai la'aret asher Hashem lokecha notemach, lo tilmad la'asot ketoivot ha'goyimahem. Right? The Jews are about to go into the land of Israel. I should be more specific here. The land of Canaan. It's a land that had been filled by Canaanites and people who had done all kinds of terrible practices. So the Pasuk tells us that you should not learn to do like the abominations of the Goyim. So, for example, Lo yim sabach ma'vir ben obito be'esh. There should not be found amongst you someone who passes their son or daughter in fire, a reference to Molech. Kosem kesamim, someone who does magical incantations or practices. Me'onein, umenachesh, umechashef, all different kinds of practices that are discussed in the halachic literature, in Midrash Halacha, in the Yerushalmi, in the Bavli. And then in Pasuk Yud Aleph, we have a further list. The chover chaver, the shoel ov yidoni, the doesh alamiti. Right? And these things as well are considered to be forbidden. What is chover chaver? So this is a big debate, not only amongst modern scholars, but also amongst the Targumi. Right? The various Aramaic translations that Jews used to use in synagogue, in Beit Knesset, when they were to listen to Leining, to Kriyat Torah, they would have the basic models. They would have a Bal Kore read and a Mitargame, someone who would translate into Aramaic. But there were a number of Targumim in the ancient world into Aramaic. And this is aside from the translation, the old translation into Greek. So the most well-known Targum is Targum Onkelos. Targum Onkelos, for the most part, seems to be a Babylonian Targum. We have other Targumim as well. Targum Yonatan, Targum Neophiti. Those are other Targumim that would be used in Shul to translate and explain what's going on in the Sukkim. How do the Targumim translate Chover Chaver? So, for example, Targum Yonatan ben Uziel says, and this is on the handout, it says, Umechabrin v'asarin chivin v'akravin v'chol mine rachashim. The word chover chaver was assumed to refer to the verb mechaber, to join something. What kind of magical practice would be joining or binding things? This was a form of snake charming, according to the Targum Yonatan, and also the Targum Yufit. So therefore, that's the practice that was referred to in the Pasuk. What does the Babylonian Targum Onkelos, say about this Pasuk? It uses the verb uratin ratan, and murmur, murmuring. That verb, and I didn't get a chance to really show you how important that verb is, but that verb is the verb that's used to describe Zoroastrian murmuring. In other words, it seems that when Jews in Babel would read this Pasuk, they would assume that part of what the Torah is forbidding is the practice of Zoroastrian murmuring. How do I know? Not only because of the use of the verb, but also because the other main name for Zoroastrian priests in the Gemara, aside from Amgusha, is Chabara. Chabara seems to come from this Pasuk. In other words, based on this Pasuk and the way this Pasuk was understood, the Zoroastrian priests were considered to be the prime examples of Chover Chaver. They were the prime examples of Chabarai. These people who performed these murmuring magical practices which the Pasuk in Devarim had forbade. So there you have it. If you go back then to the source, the discussion between Rav and Shmuel, you find that they seem to be referring to the recitation of the Avesta. One considered it to be merely blasphemy, which we learn is permitted to be studied. You just can't practice it. I'm sorry, not blasphemy, sorcery. And actually, that pasuk, Lo Tumad La Sota, and the drash, and the La Talamid La Vinu La Ro, is on those psukim in Dvarim Perek Yud Chet. So if the Babylonian Jews understood Chover Chover is referring to these kinds of Zoroastrian practices, then they would think that it is permitted to study. On the other hand, Rav considered it to be blasphemy, somehow blaspheming the name of God, and therefore it's punishable by death. So we might add, before we go on to the next source, that it could be that Jews were studying this Avesta and these recitations, because in the ancient world, it was assumed that these Zoroastrian priests had sort of magical powers and mantric powers. Through reciting their texts, some people thought that they were able to have great power over things. That, by the way, is one of the reasons why there's a connection between magi, the old word for Zoroastrian priest, and magic, because the Greeks made this connection as well, in a detrimental way, but that somehow these Zoroastrian priests, the magi, were engaging in magic, what we now call magic. And if you look at, I wish we had time to do this, we don't, if you look at a Zoroastrian source from a book called the Herbetistan, which is about Zoroastrian study and the laws of study, so to speak, Hilchot Talmud Torah Lahavdil, you'll find that there's a whole question as to whether Zoroastrian priests are allowed to teach non-Zoroastrians, which is exactly what Rav is referring to from the other end. Rav is saying Jews should not be going and studying Devarim. You could say things, or I might argue words. That is one sense of the word Devar, from Zoroastrian priests. And this Middle Persian text and Avestan text is referring to, from the Zoroastrian perspective, are you allowed to teach non-Zoroastrian students? Why would they want to learn the Avesta? It seems that, again, it has to do with what was conceived as the power, the magical power of these words. And in fact, when they discussed it, it's a question of whether the mantra, right, which is mantra, which is a cognate of the Indian word that's made its way into English, Sanskrit word, mantra, that's what people would be coming to study. And sure, the Zoroastrian said it's forbidden, but there are ways of getting around it if there's payment. So you have a very interesting discussion between Rav and Shmuel about not necessarily whether Zoroastrianism as a religion is a Vodizara, but the question of whether this major Zoroastrian practice of reciting the Avesta, perhaps for magical reasons, is considered to be a form of blasphemy or a form of sorcery. Any quick questions before we go on to the next thing? I know there was a lot to kind of digest. Okay, so we're just going to onward. Oh, we have a question. Oh, the book, it's not a book. The Talmud and its World, Neil, is the name of this lecture series. So we're just going to quickly go to one other source because time is running out. And we're going to talk about an encounter between a Zoroastrian and an Amora. This is from Sanhedrin Lamed Tet Amud Aleph. Amar li Ahuam Bushel Ameima. A certain Zoroastrian priest said to Ameima, Mi Palgan li, or Mi Palgach it should be li Eli de Hormin. Mi, or de Hormiz. I don't know, I used the wrong girsa here. I apologize. Mi Palgan li Tatai de Ahormin. Or Arima. This Zoroastrian priest, this Magus, says to Amema, from your waist and upward is associated with Ormaz, it seems to be. This is a text where the scribe didn't know what to write exactly. And from your waist and downward is related to Arimaz. So again, if you remember the two main forces in Zoroastrianism, which we learned in part from Kurdish inscription, Ormuz is from the waist and upward. He refers to everything good, according to the Thracian priest, and Ahriman refers to everything from the waist downwards. What's Amemar's response to this? Amar lay. Amemar said, how could you really posit such a divide? How could Ahriman permit Ormuz to allow water to go through, it seems urine, to travel through the body and onto the ground? Very strange debate. On one side you have an Amora, a Amemar. On the other side you have a Zoroastrian priest. The Zoroastrian priest is trying to convince Amemar that not only is there a basic dualistic split in the world, that there are some things that are evil and some things that are good, that there's a good God and there's a bad God, but that dualistic format can be mapped onto the body. So from the waist and up is referring to Ormuz, from the waist is down is referring to Ahriman, is part of the territory of Ahriman. Amemar responds, the fact that the body needs to work in harmony when it needs to urinate shows that your conception is incorrect, and the body is one unified entity, presumably one unified entity that is God's creation, right, that is associated with everything that's good. This debate, actually, a form of this debate appears in another text, a text between not a Zoroastrian and a Jew, but between a Zoroastrian and a Muslim. This text is about a Zoroastrian named Abalish, who converted from Islam from Zoroastrianism to Islam in the 9th century of the Common Era. And a debate was staged in front of the Abbasid Caliph, Al-Ma'mun. And one of the questions is why Zoroastrians put on a special belt, a ritual belt called the Kusti. Why is that so important to them? He humorously asks, I mean, you know, animals have belts put on them all the time and girdles put on them all the time. Are they going to go into heaven first? And the Zoroastrian priest, Abdurbar di Farnbag, explains to Abalish in this debate that the purpose of the belt is to divide between the upper and lower parts of the body. The upper part is associated with Ormuz. The lower part is associated with Ahriman. Why is the upper part associated with Ormuz? Because the intellect is there, the senses are there, consciousness, memory, you can see it in the text. And why is the lower part associated with Ahriman? Not because of anything having to do with sexuality. The Zoroastrians seem to not think that sexuality and procreation was positive. That wasn't part of the debate. Because at the place of foulness and filth, the bladder, excrement, urine, etc., right? That's what was wrong with the lower part of the body. That's why it was associated with Ahriman. And the Kustig was supposed to be the boundary of the body and divide between the upper and the lower parts. Stanley says it sounds like a gartel. Yes, indeed, it sounds very much like a gartel. We are kind of running out of time, but if I don't remember next time, I want to talk about that issue, because we have something similar as well in a few Gemaras. What I want to use this text to do is to think about a Maimar's response to the Zoroastrian priest. It wasn't simply a throwaway comment, right? Because from the Zoroastrian side, we've seen this 9th century text that urine is very important in mapping the territory of Ormuz and Ahriman. And Amemar basically would be responding, I don't care whether urine is, you know, can be found in the lower part of the body. It still testifies to the connection between the upper and lower part of the bodies. I think we're going to have to stop here, and we're going to go back to this at the beginning of next class. And the rest of next class, we're going to talk about some of the other religions that Kurder mentioned as well, Eastern Christianity, Manichaeism, and maybe even Manichaeism. I have a couple of minutes for questions, so I don't really have that much time to answer. As always, feel free to email me at shysekunda@gmail.com. Next class, of course, oh, I just sent that just to Shalom, hold on. Next class is going to be next Sunday. I assume we're not canceled for Sarva Davies. Yes, I can ask the technical people to do that, to make the handouts available. Well, they are available online, but I assume you need to download. We'll try to do that. Any other questions? Okay. So if not, feel free to email me, and we're going to get back to this text next time. Oh, is there no class next Sunday? Shalom? I guess we'll find out. Whatever they tell me to do, if there is class, I'll teach, and if not, I won't teach. I personally would like to teach, even if I'll be a bit hungry. Maybe I'll munch on something in the middle, because I'll be breaking the fast in Israel. Okay, so everyone should have a wonderful day, and I look forward to seeing you next Sunday, or I guess the Sunday after. I'll try to clarify that with the Torah Motion staff. Have a great day.